Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Italian actress and international beauty, Sophia Loren. And she has a really interesting and humble backstory, Mike, and I'm sure you know all of these details. In fact, you probably know them better than I do. Maybe you want to do the intro for Sophia.
It's interesting when you mention her as an actress and international beauty, because I think that's always been a consideration throughout her career. She's one of the world's most beautiful women. When people would put me on the spot, I usually try to duck questions like this, but people would put me on the spot saying, who's the most beautiful actress ever? That kind of question, right? And for me, she was always my number one pick, always on that short list. I mean, I really think she's just a stunning beauty, and yet in some ways an unconventional beauty. There have been things written about her where they say, well, if you analyze her nose, and if you look at this, you know what I mean? Like they kind of do the anatomy, and like these things should not all go together so well, blah, blah, blah. And I say, yeah, but then you look at her and somehow it meshes, it blends, it's perfect, but just a stunning personality. Now that's a mixed blessing. When you're so incredibly good looking, how seriously will you be taken as an actor? And this is something, Marie, you and I can talk about throughout the episode. And it was something that was always of concern to her as well. But in any event, when you mention humble origins, these go beyond humble. Think about this. She's now 86 years old. And so she grew up during World War II. Number one, she was illegitimate, which, you know, nowadays do people even mention that? But back then, that was a huge social concern. You know, you'd be stigmatized, basically, right? The fact that she was illegitimate. But on a pragmatic level, her mother was raising Sophia and her sister, you know, on her own, basically. Now, the mother was, and she, although she was born in Rome, Sophia Loren grew up in Naples. And in fact, she's my favorite description of her is she's been described as a Neapolitan Aphrodite. And I think that's really apt in a lot of ways. But when she grew up in Naples, just grinding poverty, really struggling, some of her later roles, like Two Women and some other things we can talk about, overtly play off of that. She knows what that kind of hardship is like early in life. And I think it really forms her character. So again, the beauty is there. You can see her as like, you know, one of the ultimate fashion magazine icons, if you will. And I think actually, when you look at the overall career, it's a matter of, you know, she's made some really great films, but not a lot, frankly. She's also done a lot of standard commercial films, you know, but what has always been a constant for her is that image as essentially a cultural icon. There are actors like that whose status is so enormous. And in her case, you know, when you think about Italy, you think about her, right? She's on that short list. And a lot of the movies just sort of came and went, right? But the lasting image she had. Now, in any event, back to that childhood, her mother was an amateur actress, an aspiring actress, I should put it that way, and became, I think, one of the ultimate stage mothers. Her mother ended up finding fulfillment through young Sophia, pushing her into the business, if you will. And in fact, took her once to Rome, where they were extras in Quo Vadis, one of these big Hollywood productions shot in Italy, you know, and this is a time when Italy and Rome in particular was oftentimes referred to as Hollywood on the Tiber. We can double back on this perhaps, the number of American films, particularly sword and sandal type films that were being made in Italy. So she and her mom actually were extras in Quo Vadis. And so, you know, that bit of not just filmmaking, but of Hollywood style filmmaking was there. The other most notable thing about her childhood into her early teen years is the fact that she was always being entered into beauty contests. Now, we can smile nowadays about beauty contests and, you know, go on and on with that in all sorts of ways. But I got to tell you, back then, they were taken very seriously. And a mother who wanted to get her daughter into the public limelight, if you will, might well have entered her into contests like this. And everyone watched, everyone read about them, everyone cared. But nowadays, you'd be like, well, who cares? But no, they really cared about this. Now, the funniest thing is that Sophia Loren was like never winning any of these. She was always like a runner up. One time they gave her a consolation prize called Princess of the Sea. Now, I wonder if she put that on her resume. Can you imagine putting you were the Princess of the Sea? But the really funny thing about that from my perspective is here in the early 1950s, late 40s, early 50s, Sophia Loren's a runner up in all these beauty pageants. And I want to know if she lost, who won? Can you imagine? And what happened to them? They probably became telephone operators or something. But, you know, she was the one who was always getting close, but not quite there. So let me hand it back to you at this point, Marie, because by the early 50s, by 1952, Sophia Loren, as they're trying to launch her, actually had a couple other names she was known by early in her career. And from 1952 onwards was Sophia Loren. And this is the point where she's starting to make movies in Italy. And I got to tell you, because she's so beautiful and because she was known for the beauty pageants, the earliest films oftentimes are really marked to their discredit by that. Just simply, she's stunning. Just put her in the film and, you know, turn on the camera. And I have not seen what I think is her first film or among the first, but I can give you the translation from the Italian. Actually, it was released in this country under two titles. And the reason I want to share this with you is partly to giggle at it, but also to give you a sense that, you know, she was being exploited as a great beauty as much as anything. So anyway, way back in 1952, as her screen career truly begins, the translation I've seen for this film is Girls Marked for Danger. And it's been alternately translated as something which obviously doesn't literally translate from the Italian, but the other alternate title for its American release would have been The White Slave Trade. So these are not exactly highbrow films. We're not talking art cinema here. Let me turn it back to you at this point.
I'm glad you mentioned her mother being the stage mother, because her mother won an All Italy Greta Garbo lookalike contest run by MGM in 1932. But her mother wouldn't let her go pursue Hollywood because she was only 17. And soon after, she became pregnant with Sophia. And of course, you know, then she has this daughter who's incredibly beautiful. And so it kind of makes sense that she would push her into beauty contests, because that's what she knew. And that would have paved the way for her to have gone into movies, although it didn't work out that way. Apparently, in one of those beauty contests that Sophia Loren entered, she came in second, but they gave her the prize of Miss Eleganza. And I'm with you. I want to know who won, because she must have just been incredible looking. Or the fix was in. I also want to say, Mike, that although beauty contests have kind of gone out of style in a way in this country, they're still really big in some other countries and taken very, very seriously, because it's a way to launch a career.
But Marie, you know, in Italy, it really was one of those countries where this was super serious. Like, newspapers would have photos and articles splashed on the front page. And we giggle just like at the names of some of the contests or the titles, the crowns and all that. But just doubling back on this, how seriously this was taken. So yeah, her mom would have pushed her that way. And again, her mother is living through her. The mother, you're right, Marie, had been herself in beauty contests, had been trying to get into the movies and so on. Now, where this turns to pragmatic advantages, number one, it gets her noticed. When you're that beautiful, even if you're a runner up, you know, people notice, who's that girl on the left, kind of notice, right? But very, very seriously, in terms of how the career evolves, when Sophia Loren was 14 years old and she was entered in one of these beauty contests, she met one of the judges, Carlo Ponti, who would become, you know, he was a great film producer for so many decades, and of course would be her husband for 50 years. And we'll talk more about that, but that's actually where that partnership begins. So things are coming into place there in her mid-teens. Admittedly, the earliest films, and frankly, throughout her career, she makes some less than great films, but by 1953, 54, it's starting to coalesce. And this is really where the career is going to take off in terms of stardom, you know, and not just in Italian films, but very quickly in American films, some shot in Italy, some shot in the USA.
You know, I want to mention some of the titles of some of the movies that she made in the 50s, because they all just have this, you know, sort of salacious undertone to them. But the titles are great. 1959, That Kind of Woman, and 1954, Too Bad She's Bad. And then 1955, Scandal in Sorrento. I mean, it sounds like the lurid titles of, you know, potboiler romances. But it is significant that she met Carlo Ponti when she was so young, because that's sort of one of the trajectories of beautiful women. You know, a Svengali type comes along older, and I think he was 22 years her senior.
24 years.
24 years, okay.
Yeah, 24 years older.
And, you know, you think there's got to be an element there, given her background, that, you know, she might have been looking for some sort of father figure, some sort of security. And, you know, plus he made her career happen. I mean, we do have to kind of hand it to him for that. How do you feel about Carlo Ponti as her career maker?
Well, you know what? From our perspective today, when we talk about her being exploited in the early movies, and not like you, I love looking just at those film titles. They're so funny to read. You can imagine, when I was putting it very politely before, and I said she was in like standard commercial fare that sometimes exploited the beauty, but boy, did it, imagine those titles on the marquee, you know, like Scandal and Sorrento type titles. Now, in terms of Carlo Ponti, the difference is there. Let's talk some numbers. He was 24 years older, an established producer, and he really, you know, he makes his share of potboilers over the years or standard commercial films, but he also makes some really great films too. I mean, he's the producer for Jean-Luc Godard's Contempt. He's the producer for Michelangelo Antonioni's Blow Up. You know what I mean? So it's a real mixed bag for him. He's a working producer. Some of the stuff qualifies as great art cinema. Some of it's just frankly going for a dollar at the box office, you know, lira at the box office. But in terms of numbers there, that, you know, she's, you know, 14, he's 24 years older. Also a number that should be mentioned here is that he's very short. And at 5'8", she was actually considered very tall for that period. And sometimes it caused some problems in casting. We'll be talking a little bit about some of the great, or at least significant Hollywood actors she worked with. But in one of her films, she co-starred with Alan Ladd. And Alan Ladd was notoriously short. So the discrepancy there, you know, not just that she's so stunning, but she's stunningly taller than him, which, again, in terms of conventional romantic pairings, to have the actress so much taller than the actor, you get some creative framing, or you get out a, you know, a milk box or some, a milk crate, and you put him on top of it, however you handle that. But
look, you know, I want to mention about Boy and a Dolphin and the height difference.
It is Boy and a Dolphin, yeah.
Which is from 1957, if anybody wants to look it up. She actually was required to walk in a trench in order to give audiences the impression that Alan Ladd was taller than her.
That's a great detail, isn't it?
It's
one thing, it would be one thing to put him on top of a milk crate, which actually broadcasters and actors do all the time. And they find ways to make Tom Cruise look taller. I mean, the platform heels have a lot to do with that. And so that's an issue, you know, if Tom Cruise is still dealing with that because he was so much shorter than Nicole Kidman, you know, to make him look taller. But since we were talking about their marriage, from our perspective today, like all joking aside, from our perspective today, we tend to think of him as Svengali, controlling. And yes, you know, by way of armchair psychoanalysis, she's looking for a father figure, all that. But the tendency we have today is to look on him as being among the exploiters. I don't see it that way, and she does not see it that way. She's been asked about that in interviews more politely than we're putting it, probably. But that marriage lasted for 50 years. Every indication it was happy. Two beautiful sons produced by it. I mean, she always appreciated what she did. She had two father figures. One would have been Carlo Ponti. Very quickly, I'll mention the other, which is the director, Vittorio De Sica. We think of De Sica for, you know, Bicycle Thieves and you know, the great neorealist films. He also did his own background as an actor was in comic theater and comic films. He also directed a lot of comic films. With Sophia Loren, starting with Golden Naples in 1954, he would direct her in several films, which we'll talk about presently. Those are among her career highlights. She loved and absolutely respected Vittorio De Sica. And also many of those films with De Sica were produced by, guess who? Carlo Ponti. It's a tight circle they have here. Now, in terms of the marriage itself, they married in 1957. But when I describe this, it's going to sound like the plot for one of those melodramas we were making fun of before. When he was marrying Sophia Loren, he still was technically married to somebody else. They were estranged. He got what was known as a Mexican divorce. You know, the equivalent here would be like you go to Reno. I mean, so many movies make references to that. Or in Maryland, you go to Elkton or, you know, you go places. To get married fast or divorced fast, that kind of thing, right? So anyway, he got a Mexican divorce and thought that's it, he can marry her. There's nothing quite like the Italian bureaucracy. And as an Italian American, I can cast aspersions at my people, at our ethnic background. And in fact, again, kidding aside, a lot of Italian films, particularly comedies, have dealt with the intractable Italian bureaucracy. When you get pulled into that, oh man, abandon all hope, right? So anyway, what happened here was, the Italian government was not recognizing his Mexican divorce, whether despite him or despite Mexico or just, you know, thick-headed, who knows. They weren't acknowledging it. So they accused Carlo Ponti of bigamy, which, you know, nowadays would still be a problem. But back then it's on a par with being illegitimate and everything else. Oh my God, you know, as if all that weren't enough, you know, bigamy. So what they had to do was, and at that time, divorce was illegal in Italy. So they got you in a bind, don't they? You're not officially married. And if you were, you couldn't get divorced. You know, a lot of Italian comedies actually were made about things like this in the 60s in particular. So the marriage was annulled in 1962. Carlo Ponti and Sophia Loren at that point, they actually became French citizens. And then they married, or is it remarried, in 1966. It's one of the reasons why, as a married couple, they really spent most of their time out of Italy. There's a second reason for that. The second reason for that is namely that they ran into problems with the bureaucracy, with the authorities in terms of taxes. And so ultimately, through all that mess, they ended up living in Switzerland, where she still lives. She's a resident of Geneva and has been for many years. But then they, you know, from 1966 onwards, they were married again. And again, you know, even though all indications that I have are as it was a happy marriage, oh my goodness, you know, just the melodramatic hoops they went through in those early years with it.
You know, it's interesting that, you know, she did have two sons, and her son Eduardo has directed her at least in one movie that I've seen, which is the current movie on Netflix called The Life Ahead. And you had mentioned the various names that she had tried out before settling on Sophia Loren. One of them was Sophia Lazzaro, which, you know, they named her that because she was so beautiful, she could raise men from the dead like Lazarus. But I think we should dive into some of her movies. Now, you know, I always like to ask where you first were exposed to Sophia Loren. So I'm going to have to tell you that in the 70s, I remember her as being, you know, that beautiful Italian lady who sold the glasses. I knew she was famous. I knew she was an actress. I'd never seen her in anything, but she was cited in an episode of The Partridge Family, where Shirley Jones is, you know, talking about her career, you know, something going her way. And she says, you know, maybe I'll be the next Sophia Loren. And the two littlest kids say, who? And so it was served up as sort of one of those, you know, kids say the darndest things, but also something adults would understand. But I remember as a child, I knew who Sophia Loren was. It wasn't until later, when I was teaching women in film with Helen Mitchell, that I discovered the movie Two Women. Now, I don't know if you want to talk about her other movies that came before Two Women, but it is a De Sica movie. It is, you know, a little bit of a, I would say it's a neorealistic masterpiece. But since we're going to talk about that aspect, Mike, and I know you teach a special version of our European film class in Italian film, do you want to give a quick synopsis of neorealism and lead us into De Sica and Two Women?
Sure. In terms of neorealism, Vittorio De Sica, you know, one of the greatest Italian directors, his personal background really was in comic theater and films and so on. And then he became famous, ironically, for the opposite of that, because the kind of comedy he was known for was a kind of boulevard comedy, bedroom farces, silly, artificial stuff, sometimes really good. I'm not saying it in a negative way necessarily. But what he's best known for is, again, the flip, the opposite of that. So, you know, here he is in wartime Italy, and he's working under a fascist film regime, if you will. But he does work during the war years, kind of, sort of. But really, as the war ends, 1945, from then into the late 40s, films like Bicycle Thieves from 1948, and other films like, you know, Shoeshine and Umberto Day, and, you know, and really great neorealist classics. The things that, there's so much to say about neorealism, but very quickly, that it's the opposite of the kind of artifice I was just mentioning. It's, you know, working on location, often with non-professional actors, not always. Sometimes, you know, people like Anna Magnani are professional actors, and Roberto Rossellini, the other great Italian director of that period, of course, worked with her so notably. But to work on location, non-professionals, to show, to reflect the everyday reality of Italians, not just the privation during World War II, though many of the stories are set then, but in the years just after that. Italy did not bounce back immediately. I mean, a few years after that, you know, it did by the 50s, economic miracle start to bounce back in a dramatic way. But in the mid to late 40s, still a lot of hardship. So anyway, De Sica is known for those extremely realistic films. It's more complicated than that, because when you actually watch the films, they have theatrical elements too. But anyway, known for an almost quasi-documentary quality. And what happens is that, you know, he's so known for that. But by the early 50s, and certainly for the rest of his career, he'll make a few more films like that in that vein, but he'll make films that more often are comedies and very close to his own origins that way. So as he starts to work with Sophia Loren, that becomes a great partnership. And as I mentioned earlier, he is like a father figure to her. And just as she always spoke so well of her husband, Carlo Ponti, she spoke just as well of, you know, Vittorio De Sica, what he meant. Now, in terms of what she's doing, where she's been, At this point in the mid to late 50s, because of her great beauty, because of Hollywood making some of its movies in Italy and also bringing some Italian actors to Hollywood, it goes both ways. Anna Magnani had that experience as well. Sophia Loren makes films like when Marie and I earlier mentioned Buena Dolphin with the vertically challenged Alan Ladd. There also are films like The Pride and the Passion, Houseboat, The Black Orchid, Heller in Pink Tights. Some of these made with real name directors like George Cukor and with famous Hollywood actors. She appears in movies with Cary Grant, Frank Sinatra, Anthony Quinn. I mean, it's really something. And yet the movies themselves, for the most part, are not exactly career highlights for anybody. Again, a case where because of her extreme beauty, if I can put it that way, she gets cast. They don't always know quite what to do with her. Her English at first is a challenge. She learns to speak, you know, fairly decent English, but, you know, it's an effort. It's studied. And in the early films, if her performances seem kind of wooden sometimes, she's really dealing with the words like word by word. She can memorize a script, but that's not quite fluency. And so some of the characters take that into account. Some of the characters she plays, it's kind of awkward. Like, why doesn't she just talk, you know, as fast as I'm talking? Why, you know? So anyway, the early Hollywood films are a very mixed bag. To your question, in a long-winded way, I've gotten to your question. To your question about two women, it's released in 1960. Vittoria De Sica is the director. It is, I would say, her greatest performance. The film is an absolute masterpiece. To back up what I'm saying, she wins the Academy Award as Best Actress. I can't overstate the significance of this because she was the first actor in a subtitled film. I have to qualify it this way. The first actor in a subtitled film to win the top acting prize at the Academy Awards. I mean, you know, so that leaves out like, you know, if you think about Great Britain and some of the films from there, you know, well, it's our, we share a language more or less. But when you think about, you know, an Italian film with subtitles, to have her win the Academy Award as Best Actress, I've gone back and looked at the coverage. And it really, if you didn't know her before as a cultural icon, or you hadn't seen that standard issue Hollywood stuff she was making in previous years, everyone knew that whether they actually watched Two Women, it did get a wide release, but they knew her at that point. The film is a perfect role for her, Marie, because in the film, she plays a mother in war-ravaged Italy, the very upbringing she knew, and she gets to play her own mother in a way. She plays the mother here. A young actress named Eleanor Brown plays the daughter, and the struggles they go through, you know, are just incredible, but very close to not only her own life, but to the kind of neorealism that we've just been talking about. So here's De Sica returning already to his neorealist phase, if you will, and she's making a movie in that vein, and it gets incredible recognition. Just one final assessment in terms of winning the Academy Award. The people she was up against, the women she was up against that year, when she won the Oscar that year, she beat out Audrey Hepburn in Breakfast at Tiffany's. She beat out Geraldine Page in Summer and Smoke, Natalie Wood in Splendor in the Grass, Piper Laurie in The Hustler. Any one of them would have deserved the award. Those are all really strong performances, but it went to this Italian actress speaking in Italian, and you had to read the dialogue and subtitles. That is really something.
That is really something. I do want to mention about Houseboat from 1958 and The Pride and the Passion of 1957, because there are two movies that she made with Cary Grant. And in Houseboat, you do get to hear her sing. She did have a singing career and did some songs with Peter Sellers, including the great song Bangers and Mash, which I happen to like. Houseboat is just your standard romantic comedy where Cary Grant plays a widower with some children and the bombshell nanny shows up to, you know, take care of the kids. And in a lot of ways, it's very stereotypical. You know, she's the feisty Italian woman who enters the scene. It was filmed after Cary Grant and Sophia Loren's whirlwind affair during the filming of Pride and the Passion. If you watch Houseboat, catch the flip side of the story in Grant's later Father Goose as a drunken reprobate with a boat who must deal with governess Leslie Caron and her charges. The two movies actually kind of go well together. But interestingly, in terms of The Pride and the Passion, he was so obsessed with Sophia Loren that his wife, Betsy Drake, left Spain to return to the U.S. And she ended up on the Andrea Doria when it sank. She was evacuated. But, you know, the affair that Cary Grant and Sophia Loren carried on was well known to everybody. And it's interesting also that Houseboat was, the screenplay was written by Betsy Drake. And originally Grant wanted her to star in it, but then the extramarital affair with Sophia Loren complicated the project. So there's just, you know, some Hollywood gossip there to know about that. In terms of the Two Women movie, what I think is interesting about it is it's such a great performance. And at the scene where she screams and throws rocks at the troops in the Jeep, she said, was the most important single instant in my career. And the Movie Land Wax Museum in Buena Park, California, chose a scene from the movie for its depiction of their Sophia Loren wax figurine, specifically the post-rape scene where she holds her daughter and says, now she's worse than dead. Now, what I think is interesting about this movie, especially winning the Academy Award for her, is that I don't think you could have made this movie in the United States, given, you know, the production code. It is a visceral, hard to watch scene. It's actually kind of a good movie to watch before watching the current The Life Ahead, because that's also a post-war story about somebody dealing with the demons of, you know, what they suffered through in the war and how do you come back from that. And that is actually an absolutely fantastic performance for her too. I think it's very likely she'll be nominated for another Academy Award for that performance. What do you think, Mike?
Well, among her later roles, I'd mention quickly Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow from the early 60s, one of her De Sica comedies. And you really get a sense of how well she plays off of actors like Marcello Mastroianni in some of the comedies she does. Speaking of that pairing of actors, A Special Day from 1977, Ettore Scola is the director. She gets to play a weary mother of six. He gets to play a gay man. They're both playing against type. And the fact that they're stretching as actors, they don't want to be just in that one mold in terms of romantic leads and comedies. A Special Day is a really good film. She receives a Lifetime Academy Award for that career achievement in 1991. And so again, this recognition from Hollywood that she is one of those lasting cultural icons. She's made important films and she's still there. And as Marie just mentioned, although she hadn't made a film since Nine in 2009, you know, she's now made another film and, you know, she doesn't need to work, but she wants to work occasionally and she still can get a really good role and she can deliver the goods, as they say. She's a strong actor when given the right role.
I wanted to mention that she was in the 2007 edition of the famous Pirelli calendar at age 72, making her the oldest model in its history. And on why she did not pose nude for that calendar, she said, when Sophia Loren is naked, that is a lot of nakedness. I have two quotes of hers also that I think are worth mentioning. One is that a woman's dress should be like a barbed wire fence, serving its purpose without obstructing the view. And sex appeal is 50% what you've got and 50% what people think you got. And that actually wraps up our episode for this week. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.